radical left has taken over the Democratic Party.
Hello and welcome to Think Progressively, covering politics and all the other chaos life has to offer. This is episode 17, recorded on Thursday, December 10th from Milwaukee. I'm Joe.
And I'm Jason. Happy Cyberpunk Day, everybody.
It's finally here. I didn't know what you were going to say, and okay, I'm okay with this.
You're on board?
I'm on board. I don't have a way to play it, though.
Oh, I got it for the PC.
Oh, I only have like a laptop, so I can't really do much. Could it handle a laptop?
It really depends on your laptop.
I have a Mac.
I would look into it. I don't know if it's going to be coming out for Mac OS or not.
Either way, on today's episode, we ask if the U.S. government should cancel student loan debt. But first, the headlines.
Fake news.
Fake, disgusting news.
Up first in headlines, the U.S. House of Representatives voted to decriminalize marijuana. Finally, about time.
You can get that arrest expunged from your record.
Woo! The House voted on Friday on the Marijuana Opportunity Reinvestment and Expungement Act.
They love their acronym.
Oh my God. Or the MORE Act. Why not? Which decriminalizes cannabis and clears the way to erase nonviolent federal marijuana convictions. Now, obviously, we got to keep in mind here, this is not legalization of marijuana. This is just decriminalization, which is still good. But we're slowly making progress. This has absolutely no shot in the Senate.
So we're not actually making progress.
But it looks like it, and that's what matters. That's politics, Jason. It's all about looks. Optics.
I mean, it's nice, I guess. I think they've got bigger matters to attend to. It's popular. Anytime there's any drug decriminalization or legalization measures on ballots lately, they've always been passing, even in highly Republican states.
I mean, heck, what was it, Montana that just passed Reformation?
I don't remember them all. There were a few. I know Florida passed theirs.
Of the vote count, 222 Democrats were in favor of passing the act, and 6 douchebags were against it. Weirdly enough, 5 Republicans voted in favor of it, including our favorite, Matt Gaetz.
See, maybe Floridians just really like drugs. The Florida man is real.
I'm not even surprised that Matt Gaetz is okay with this, though. Where, I mean, he's just some douchey frat boy at the end of the day. Of course frat boys love drugs.
Yeah, I just don't see the problem with it. I mean, it's certainly less harmful than alcohol, and that's legal. I mean, marijuana is non-addictive. They're still going to have the same laws that you have against drunk driving. You know, you're not going to be able to drive a car, operate machinery, whatever. It's fine. Paves the way for sports leagues to stop suspending athletes for it. Paves the way for businesses to not deny hiring for people that have it.
Or firing people who have.
There's no point in having it as such an illicit Schedule I narcotic. It makes no sense.
But we still have Mitch McConnell to deal with. So, again, don't expect anything out of this in the Senate unless we vote in Ossoff and Warnock. Then maybe we have a chance. So go donate to their stuff and volunteer.
Or just have a big smoke-in at the Capitol and hotbox the entire Senate. And only give them Doritos if they vote for it.
I'm sure that'll go over well.
There'll be a familiar face in Joe Biden's chief medical advisor role. Anthony Fauci says he's accepted the job.
Which I'm not surprised about at all. I mean, are you?
No, everyone knew that he would have some prominent role.
And now he gets to work for the man he voted for.
Biden told CNN on Thursday that he asked Fauci to become his chief medical advisor and part of his COVID-19 response team. On Friday, Fauci told NBC's Today that he accepted the position. Oh, absolutely. I said yes on the spot, Fauci said when asked if he'd taken the role.
Well, and why wouldn't he?
It's something he's been doing for, what, like the past 5 administrations?
Yep.
Not much more we can really say on this topic.
But it's some good news.
Yeah, and he will be part of the transition team.
Yeah.
He'll be able to have the meetings, and he can really fill them in on everything that has been happening in the Trump administration over the past year. So that's kind of helpful as well.
I'm just excited to see him really supported compared to what he's been dealing with for the last 4 years. And in more good news, a federal judge restores DACA.
Woo! U.S. District Judge Nicholas Garofis in Brooklyn said that he was fully restoring the 8-year-old Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. They didn't make a word out of that one. Program to the days before the Trump administration tried to end it in September of 2017. He ordered the Department of Homeland Security to post a public notice by Monday to accept first-time applicants and ensure that work permits are valid for 2 years. It's good news.
Yes.
It's not immigration reform, but it's at least...
We're getting back to pre-Trump.
Getting back to a program that was wildly popular, even among Republicans.
I mean, but this is kind of what we need to expect from the next, what, at least 2 to 4 years, I'd say, at the very least, where we need just to praise the very small victories of just getting back to somewhat normal again.
Yeah, this is what we can expect out of the Joe Biden administration, which is just reversing the damage that Trump did and
maybe do a little help
getting back to the Obama administration
goals and benchmarks.
Yeah. I mean, and again, as we all saw from the Obama administration, not quite the hope and change that we wanted, but better than the last 4 years.
By a lot.
Let's all remember, this is a program for people that were brought here while they were children by their parents. So the least that we could possibly do for immigrants, but at least we are doing it once again. In an unsurprising story, schools are having to confront an increased number of failing grades from kids learning at home.
Now, Jason, I put this in here because I really wanted to talk a little bit about the struggles that schools are facing right now. I think this could be like its own main segment someday. I have no idea, but I think it's something that we should at least talk about for the moment.
Well, I'm not surprised personally. Kids have a million distractions that while they're working from home and no one can physically be with them unless their parents happen to not be working or something else where they can have some supervision. I know me, I was not the most attentive student in the world. You couldn't say, okay, it's on you to have to sit in this chair for 6-7 hours a day and focus on schoolwork and not open up 10 other windows and explore everything the internet has to offer. That would not work for me at all.
And this really isn't like an actual widespread article here. Like, this isn't a study that was done or anything. Like, this ABC's news article is more like a long-form investigative type of article where they're just kind of going through different school districts, talking to teachers, talking to principals, and just getting their stories about what's happening so far. So, for example, at McNary High School in Oregon, where 38% of grades in late October were failing, compared with 8% in normal times, which, like you said, like, this is unfortunate, but I guess you can say expected too. Like, this sucks. This is really bad.
Yeah, this is why we would hopefully have had this taken care of over the summer and have COVID transmission rates to the point where schools could have been opened up safely in the fall instead of leading to the giant spike that we had post-school openings.
Well, and a lot of it's also because it's not that they're just struggling. A lot of those Fs are just straight up zeros. They're not even doing anything. None of the work. And that goes to a lot of different factors, like you said before, where they just have so many distractions in the home to begin with. But it's also because having in-person classes does help facilitate direction in a lot of ways, where, at least according to this article, you have students who are saying that they would attempt homework, and since they didn't have any good way of contacting the teacher right away, they would just stop and just not even try.
I do wonder if this is also affecting lower income houses more. They generally have,
I'm sure,
less access to high speed internet. The neighborhoods are probably a little bit more chaotic. Normally, you know, kids can kind of escape that atmosphere by going to school for a few hours a day. Now they're having to spend all day at home in a probably less than ideal atmosphere for learning.
And what's really getting hit hard right now is, like this article also talks about, is the ESL students, the English as a second language students, where they just don't even know where to begin sometimes when it comes to this virtual instruction. And a big reason why I wanted to bring this up, Jason, is because I'm curious on getting your thoughts on adjusting grades to make it more acceptable for students who are struggling right now.
Anything they can do to help kids out and give them that little bit extra assistance that they might need. These are not normal times. You're trying to learn from home. You don't have any kind of direct interaction with your teacher, with any of your classmates. It's very strange for everyone involved. I don't see the harm. And I never liked the, I think our school system could use less testing to begin with and more, I don't even know the term, but less rote learning and a more interactive system, which you really can't do right now. The things that I would really push for are even harder to do remotely. But yeah, so I'm all for if they're going to change it so that missed assignments hurt less. I was very bad at ever doing homework. Whenever I was home, I really wasn't doing any work. So I couldn't imagine personally doing this remote learning because, like I said, there's no way I would be using the computer for everything except schoolwork.
How do you think this will impact the virtual versus in-person schooling debate?
I think it shows that it's not a replacement for classroom learning.
I'd agree with that.
I don't know that it says that it can't work for some people or in some cases.
Well, and we already knew this before. I think we talked about a WHO report where they said that these ideas with lockdowns and virtual learning is just not sustainable, especially for kids, too.
They're missing the whole social aspect as well.
Right.
No recess. I mean, I'm sure they will, like, you can take a break, but it's not the same.
Well, break to do what? Go on other things on your computer.
Right.
And I feel for schools and I feel for teachers right now because I don't know what else they can do. I mean, when you have a pandemic going around that's getting worse right now than what it was months ago, you can't put students in harm's way. You can't make sure that they're risking themselves and their own safety just to potentially get a better homework lesson in or a better like math or reading lesson in. I just don't see it. But I think this also kind of shows the point that even in the best case scenario, this sucks. Like, point blank, this just sucks.
It shows that we all, again, another reason why we all need to take COVID seriously.
To get out of this.
As soon as you're able, get vaccinated. So we have high vaccination rates. We have low community transmission. Numbers go way down. It's safe to open schools. Kids can return to in-person learning. We'll still wear masks, all that other fun stuff. But it won't be this gigantic spike of cases when they return next year, unlike what we saw this fall. That's all we can do. That's the solution.
I've seen surveys that said 46% of Americans say they're going to get the vaccine.
Hopefully it's going to be a lot higher than that.
I'm so hoping so. But until then, we have to deal with this, and there will be consequences.
And of course, we're going to hear the, oh, thanks, Democrats. This is what you get because you're caring about COVID, because you wouldn't just open all the schools and let the teachers die.
And that's what makes me really upset about this whole thing, too, where you'll see a lot of conservatives and Republicans trivializing this entire manner, saying that it has to be either that we take COVID seriously or we need to take education seriously. And they'll bring stuff up like, well, our kids aren't getting the education they need. Well, we know that. That's why this sucks. This is a really shitty situation. But there's, what do we want to do about it? We can't just let kids go out and get sick. We can't do that. So we just have to brace for as much damage as we can and try to fix it and minimize it.
Our final headline of the evening. Texas is suing us. Did you get your summons delivered by a guy in a 10-gallon hat and a giant belt buckle like I did?
I don't answer the door anymore.
Y'all home? I'm like, nope.
Y'all coming to court? Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. Oh, Ken Paxton. Is asking the U.S. Supreme Court to block the battleground states from casting unlawful and constitutionally tainted votes in the Electoral College. The four states that he's suing are Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Where do we begin?
I never liked Texas.
That's a good spot to begin with. In the suit, he claims that pandemic-era changes to the election procedures in those states violated federal law and asks the U.S. Supreme Court to block the states from voting in the Electoral College, which is, again, really stupid because those four states were not the only states that made changes in the pandemic.
But those are the states that they need to overturn the election.
Well, this is the same like nationwide strategy as you saw Trump's campaign deal with in Wisconsin, where you had, well, there are so many issues in Wisconsin, but I'm only going to have lawsuits in Dane and Milwaukee. Like, why? And what makes it worse, 17 other states' attorneys general are joining him. Those states are Missouri, Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Indiana, Kansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Montana, Nebraska, North Dakota, Oklahoma, South Carolina, South Dakota, Tennessee, Utah, and West Virginia.
All the yeehaw states.
All the yeehaw states. Except for Florida. But Florida's a mess.
This comes way too close to some sort of internal war within a country. I don't know what you would call that.
Well, this isn't civil, I can tell you that. These guys are way too crazy. So why do you think this is even happening? What do you think made Ken Paxton do this?
Because the Republicans have long ago abandoned any illusion of democracy.
Do you think this is legit? Do you think they're actually seriously, or do you think they're actually taking this seriously? Or do you think this is just a let's make Trump happy lawsuit?
I think this is a let's do anything we can to get four more years of a Republican president. It shows that they don't care about the will of the American people, that they would rather live in a dictatorship than a democracy. All they want is their way. That's all that's important. They never cared about the rules. They never cared about our laws. They'll hold up the Constitution while trying to subvert legal votes by American citizens. I don't know how else to interpret that. That's what I see. And I don't really think there's, all they're going to say is, well, it was rigged and there was fraud. But there's no, that's not reality. There's no evidence of that.
Well, and Paxton's saying that the changes we made were unconstitutional. What changes is he talking about and how are they unconstitutional?
And you know what the Constitution has to say about elections? The states handle them themselves. I don't know what standing Texas would have over how other states handle their elections. Kind of goes against that whole states' rights BS.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because in an interview, Paxton did say that for those states that acted out of accordance with the Constitution, Texans would also be affected. And that's their argument. Quote, our job is to make sure that the Constitution is followed and that every vote counts. In this case, I am not sure every vote was counted, not in the right way. It's literally just they did what I didn't want them to do, therefore they hurt Texas.
And I don't really think that's how legal standing works.
No, not even remotely. I don't know why I'm so upset by this article. I think it's because I can see Ken Paxton doing this. You know, he's shown and demonstrated that he's willing to be dumb all the time. I mean, just watch the guy on Fox News, for God's sakes.
I do like this quote from Georgia's Deputy Secretary of State, Jordan Fuchs. The allegations in the lawsuit are false and irresponsible. Texas alleges that there are 80,000 forged signatures on absentee ballots in Georgia, but they don't bring forward a single person who this happened to. That's because it didn't happen. And that is the headline of all of this nonsense surrounding this election.
Because it didn't happen?
It didn't happen. Everything they're alleging, all of this fraud, all of this malfeasance, voting irregularities, Dominion software glitches, all this nonsense.
Hugo Chavez.
It didn't happen.
And for those who are worried, that are thinking that this is a strategy to go to the U.S. Supreme Court, I highly doubt it. Because I don't think it would get anywhere near the Supreme Court, because it would probably die in the federal courts immediately.
And the Supreme Court just recently threw out that Pennsylvania lawsuit.
Yeah. So nothing's going to happen like all the other cases. Nothing will happen, but this is just more crap to give to your crazy conspiracist friends and family.
Running against the worst candidate in the history of presidential politics puts pressure on me. Could you imagine if I lose my whole life? What am I going to do? I'm going to say, I lost to the worst candidate in the history of politics. I'm not going to feel so good. Maybe I'll have to leave the country. I don't know.
Now our main story for the day. Student loan debt forgiveness. Should the U.S. government forgive student loan debt?
Yes.
Agreed.
Good show.
Done.
Glad we did this.
I've never heard anyone make that joke before. The ask a question, are you answer it.
Are you telling me I'm not funny? Home.
I don't think either one of us is very funny.
You're right.
So let's start with some numbers.
So where are we right now?
The average cost of college in the United States is $32,889 per student. That cost has doubled in the last 20 years, with an annual growth rate of 5.2%, or twice that of the growth rate of the U.S. dollar. There's currently $1.6 trillion in student loan debt in the United States. That number has tripled since 2006. Over 50% of the debt comes from households with a graduate degree. 35% of student loan balances are owed by the top individuals in the top 20% of income distribution. The total number of U.S. borrowers with student loan debt is 44.7 million, which is about 15% of the population.
So I'm guessing you know somebody, or maybe you yourself, has student loan debt.
As we previously discussed, I was a poor student, so I did not go to college. I have zero student loan debt currently, and no children. So student loan debt, not a personal concern for me.
And I had to pay mine off.
And aren't you going back to college?
And I'm going back.
So you'll be accruing some more.
Yep. But I think we need to talk about how much this actually did grow over the last 15 to 20 years. I mean, like Jason said, this literally tripled from around $486 billion of student debt to the almost $1.7 trillion today. That's insane.
And the cost of education is going up higher than most other markers. Even higher than the cost of healthcare, which is skyrocketing.
And for those of you who are interested, the degrees with the highest amount of total debt in the United States are the Masters of Business Administration, or the MBAs, law degrees, or JDs, Bachelors of Business Administration, or undergraduate business degrees, Bachelors in Nursing, which are BSNs, and then medical degrees.
The student loan delinquency or default rate is 10.8% currently. And that is loans that are 90 days or more delinquent. So as we said, 44.7 million total, 10.8%. Again, not the greatest student, but that would be somewhere in the neighborhood of 4.5 million people are in default currently on their student loans.
I mean, this is bad. This is really bad. And actually, Jason, I don't know if you knew this, but our situation right now in the United States is so bad right now that they actually have a game show to help pay for student debt called Paid Off. Did you hear about this?
While doing research for this episode, I watched the Patriot Act episode on student loan debt, and they mentioned that game show.
Oh, okay. There you go. I just want to read a little bit from this about section on the show's website. Quote, student loan debt is out of control, and Michael Torpy from Orange is the New Black is fixing it in the most inefficient way possible. A comedy game show.
It's the most capitalist way.
What is that? Oh my God.
To address student loan debt. Let's make a game show and make profit.
It continues, quote, Paid Off with Michael Torpy gives three college grads, each saddled with student debt, the chance to test their value of their education in a fun, fast-paced trivia contest. In the end, one lucky winner will have the chance to win the sum of their debt in cash.
Yay.
One lucky winner. How sad do we have to be when we are competing to pay off our student loan debt for entertainment value?
One down, only 44,699,999 to go.
So I saw that same Patriot Act episode. I wasn't going to include it in this, but what was the slogan that the guy always said at the end of the show?
I know it's not everything, really? But I hope this takes some of the pressure off.
Yeah. Just where are we as a country where this is a thing? I just don't understand this. What are we going to do next? Like a medical debt game show?
I'm just still impressed that I remembered that off the top of my head without knowing you were going to ask me that.
I'm proud of you.
Thank you.
What are we going to do? We need to do something. Debt's growing exponentially. More and more people are getting saddled with student loan debt. And it's mostly because you need a college degree to get a good paying job in your field.
Years ago, only some people went to college. Nowadays, it's like a necessity, like you just said. So,
well, for entry-level jobs, you need a college degree.
Yeah, I see quite a few that ask for a ridiculous amount of experience.
Yep.
And we constantly preach to low-income families and minorities that the way out of their situations is education.
Well, that's usually the conservative talking point, isn't it? You don't like your job, you're not making enough, why don't you go to college?
So we're pushing people to undertake this. And these are mostly federal loans that they're getting from the government, which they're being charged interest on, by the way, which I do not agree with. I don't understand how we need to make money off of giving education loans. And we're saddling people with this debt. And over the last 20 years, we've had these catastrophic situations that have made really bad employment environments for these kids coming out of college with all of this debt.
I mean, this is my generation. Millennials are getting killed right now in the job market.
At 2008, we had the recession, job market tanked. Hope you didn't graduate from college around that time with a bunch of debt, because you weren't going to find a job. Coronavirus currently, difficult to find work. So we continually have this situation where we're pushing kids to college, and I don't have anything against higher education. I didn't go. I'm not a very good student. Yet again, I feel like I'm saying that this whole episode. I wouldn't have gotten much out of college going right out of high school because I really did not enjoy school. But I was still pushed as to, you know, that's where everyone should go. That's what you should do.
No, I totally agree with you, because when we, and let's get some things straight here. I'm assuming, especially with what you just said, that we're not saying that college is for everyone. You don't necessarily have to go to college if you don't want to, but our job market is constantly raising the bar of what determines or what's expected for a entry-level position. And if you want to make a decent living in this country, you have to go to college for a lot of types of jobs. Now, there are jobs where you can kind of sit there and work for 15, 20 years and make an okay wage, but not everyone can do that. And even then, we as a country want to invest in our own citizens. We want to have a more educated population. That's what helps our country in the long run. So by helping people get out of college debt, that's going to help us for not just now, but for many years down the road too. Because you're not going to scare people that want to go into college who literally don't think they'd be able to afford it.
The reason we started all of these federal loan programs for school was to try to make us competitive with Russia. It was looking at the Cold War and Russia's advancements in satellite technology that pushed for this in the first place, because we had to get a better educated United States workforce in order to compete.
So what are we going to do then?
We have a proposal by Senators Elizabeth Warren and Chuck Schumer to eliminate $50,000 worth of student loan debt per person.
And we actually talked about this in a headline segment in a previous episode.
This would only be eligible for people who make less than $125,000 annually, which I think is reasonable.
And Verger, that's an increase actually from Elizabeth Warren's plan when she was running for president, where she said this would only be for people with $100,000 or less. So she even raised it from what she had before.
Joe Biden has proposed to eliminate $10,000 in debt per person. And his team argues that not every student loan needs forgiveness, because a lot of student loan debt is held by advantaged individuals who landed a decent job.
And I think this is a good thing to talk about as well. When we're talking about student loan debt, we do need to understand that a large part of that debt is actually held by affluent people. People who are usually already pretty well off to begin with, or come from pretty well off families and communities, and they may not need this type of relief. At least that's what the argument is.
I am not against rich people benefiting from public programs. I think that is a miscategorization about social programs, that they're only for the low income or less advantaged. I think they're really for everyone. So if somebody who's a wealthy family gets their student loan debt forgiven because of this, I don't have a problem with that personally.
Well, and me neither. I don't think so. I mean, there are several decent arguments from, we'll say, more far left individuals and representatives. They're saying this type of, we'll say, overarching support really doesn't do much to help the wealth gap. But we need to invest in our communities regardless of what it is. I understand that we should try to help out our lower income population as much as possible. But if you're a taxpayer, you should also benefit from the same programs.
And the more wealthy are paying more in taxes. So, yeah, they should also benefit.
Right. So, personally, I have no problem with it, but there's some debate going on between, we'll say, the more moderate and the more farther left of the Democratic Party. And I found an interesting quote from Adam Looney, who is a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. He said, "A better approach would cap forgiveness at $10,000 as Biden and House legislation propose. That could eliminate debt for the 15 million borrowers with smaller balances who, paradoxically, tend to struggle most, accounting for about 60% of all defaults. But Biden should also consider a more targeted approach based on the income and economic circumstances of the borrowers."
One thing in doing the research for this, I didn't include it in our notes, but one thing I did notice is that people with higher amounts of debt tend to be minority students.
Yes.
Particularly African-American and Latino students carry a higher amount of student debt than other groups.
And there's actually a really cool article from the Roosevelt Institute about student debt forgiveness options and how that relates to racial equality. And according to them, minority students tend to have around an average of $7,400 more than white students do.
So we actually risk increasing the wealth gap if we forgive a smaller amount of student loan debt.
Well, and I think it all comes down to strategy as well, where we have, we'll say, a large overbearing, not overbearing, but again, overarching stimulus versus a much more targeted and pinpoint approach.
There is, of course, all of the administrative costs in the more targeted you get as well.
Yes. But why are we focused on student loan debts as opposed to things like mortgage debt or car loan debt?
Well, the big reason is your mortgage and your car loan are generally owed to private institutions, whereas 92% of current student debt is owed to the U.S. government.
So it just makes it a lot easier to actually control that type of debt because we own it, basically. And then to make matters worse, we have students who are dealing with predatory loan management companies who are misleading them for profit. Now, I know Hasan Minhaj did his whole thing about Navient in his Patriot Act special. I recommend you check that out, too.
We're going to have to link it now. We've mentioned it three times.
Yeah, I'll find it. But I do want to talk a little bit about Navient, and for those who may not have actually seen the episode. So Navient is a very large student loan management company. They actually came from Sallie Mae, which I'm sure many of you guys already know about. As of right now, they handle approximately 1 in 4 of all student borrowers in the country. And actually, one of those borrowers was me. I went through Navient when I graduated school. The problem is they screwed over students and student borrowers for short-term profit gain. Actually, according to a 2017 lawsuit from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which we'll link in the show notes as well, the CFPB accused them of misleading students who called about income-driven repayment plans to shorten call times and to get more profits. And for those of you who don't know, income-based repayment plans would cap payments for individuals based on their income. Regulations usually require borrowers in IDR plans to recertify their income and family size to the government annually to remain in the program. And there's a bunch of other paperwork that's involved because it's a very highly regulated process. Another option for people who are struggling with paying their student loans is forbearance, which means that you can stop paying your student loans for a certain amount of time, but you pay more in interest later.
So there's certainly a financial interest for these for-profit companies to put people in forbearance so that they get more money in the long term.
So in the lawsuit, the CFPB alleges that Navient acted abusively and unfairly by not adequately advising borrowers choosing forbearance about available income-driven repayment plans. More specifically, Navient is accused of failing to engage in time-consuming and costly counseling sessions with borrowers about alternative repayment plans and the borrower's financial situation. Long story short, that means that people in the call center for Navient were expected to make call times as short as possible, and setting people up for income-based repayment plans did not let them have these short call times. So instead, they were urged to bring them towards forbearance instead.
I will say this reminds me of my former job at the now merged Time Warner Cable, where we had, I mean, if anyone's ever called the cable company, I mean, I don't need to tell you. But it's kind of the same thing. Instead of actually helping people, fixing problems,
they try to sell you and they try to keep things as short as possible. Yep.
It's just get off the phone. If you try to walk somebody through fixing an issue, that takes forever. And the company doesn't make any money off of that. So don't do that. See if you can sell them anything. Schedule a service call if you have to, but just get them off the phone. And that is one of the reasons why they were always considered one of the worst companies in America.
Yep. Also in the lawsuit.
Capitalism, everybody.
Also in the lawsuit, the CFPB points to 4 statements on Navient's website that allegedly induced borrowers to rely on Navient to act in their interests. All general statements that Navient would, quote, work with borrowers or help them find affordable repayment options. And I can't even believe this is real. But then in that same lawsuit, an attorney for Navient said, and I quote, a servicer's role is to collect payments owed by borrowers. In that role, the servicer acts in the lender's interest. Here, that lender is often the federal government itself. And there is no expectation that the servicer will act in the interest of the consumer or the students who are actually borrowing the money to begin with, which is insane.
Again, I mean, you gotta keep saying the catchphrase, but that is capitalism. That's the way it works. You always do everything in the best interest of the company, never the consumer. Always profit. Profit will always lead to the best outcome.
Well, and this is our government encouraging that type of behavior. That's the problem, too. When we are doing business with these companies, we're giving them the power to do this to us. And that's where you have candidates and senators like Elizabeth Warren who are trying to call this out as much as possible because she knows the role that the government plays in this.
So that is the horrible system we find ourselves in. What can we do about it?
Well, we can obviously try to forgive student loan debt like Schumer and Elizabeth Warren and President-elect Joe Biden is saying. However, there are other options that other countries are doing, which I think also deserve a look.
I've heard a lot in these discussions about the Australian model. Australian schools are also quite expensive, not quite as expensive as the U.S., and they do have a lot of government student loans, but their system is much more highly thought of and does not have the same amount of debt and people in delinquency that we have here. So the Australian model, they call it HECS. I've also seen HELP as an acronym. They are loan repayments that are just made through your income taxes. So you do not start paying anything back until your income reaches a certain threshold. Currently for this year, that threshold is $45,881. Those are Australian dollars. You can check the current rate. I believe the Australian dollar is a little bit under the U.S. dollar currently, so it's probably a little less than $40,000. And that rate, once you hit that rate, that $45,000, you'd be taxed at 1%. Then it goes up as your income goes up to 10% at the highest, and that would be at $135,000 or $134,000 or higher. And that is basically an income-based repayment program. It's not a separate payment that you would have to make. It automatically comes out of your income, and it is graduated based on how much money you make. And if you never make that much money, you never make any payments.
And the UK has a pretty similar system as well, where student loans aren't collected until the individual meets a certain income threshold. So if you don't have a job, the idea is you won't pay student loans because that's the whole idea of investing in your workers. And then like Australian model, well, I want to make sure I get this correct, Jace, before I say it. So when you say of taxes, is it through taxes on their paychecks or?
I am not Australian.
Okay.
Might, but I assume that it does come out automatically, just like how our income tax works.
Okay. Here. Thank you. So similar to the Australian one, also has their student loans taken out of their paychecks automatically. And then also after 25 or 30 years, based on whatever plan that you're on, your loan's actually automatically canceled if you pay it for that long. That seems pretty nice to me. And then you even have places like in the Scandinavian countries, which just have longer loan thresholds than we do.
And then you don't need those companies like Avient to manage, because it would all be automatic.
Right.
Just like
no middleman at all.
Yeah. So I don't mind putting those types of companies out of business at all.
But there are other things that we can do as well, other than restructure our repayment process or repayment system in this country. We can do things like make college more affordable to begin with. Seems like a good idea.
Biden has proposed a 2-year free community college or vocational colleges, and I would be all for that. That would
same
be
here.
That would probably be the type of education that I would still be able to do at this point in my life and benefit the most from. And if it were free, I probably would attend. I would also like to see, if not highly reducing tuition, making public universities free. I would like to see it's not been proposed, except like Bernie Sanders proposed it, but I think we could get to that. I would like to see us actually invest in education rather than some of the things that we do. They are government-run colleges. We have free public lower education. I don't see why we shouldn't have free public higher education as well.
Well, it's because for some reason in this country, people believe that going on to school is just a personal choice and that's it. The only investment that can be made from going to school is an investment in yourself. You are going to school. You want a better job. Therefore, you go get schooling in whatever field you want and try to get that better job later on. What people need to realize, though, is, again, education is a country's investment in its own population. We want an educated population because that's where our work is going. When you have manual labor jobs that are being replaced left and right, we're not going to need as many manual laborers anymore. We need more educated people to handle more complex systems. And our government needs to incentivize people to do those things. So making things like at least 2-year college and vocational programs free, that would be wonderful for what our country can do. But I mean, that leads us into criticisms of paying off student loan debt. Obviously, you've heard lots of criticisms from all over the place, whether it's from Fox News to whatever Republican representative you want to have. I don't know the guy. Who's the guy with the eye patch?
Dan Crenshaw, I believe.
Yeah, Dan Crenshaw in Texas, I believe, has been very vocal in opposition to paying off and lowering student debt. So I want to go through some of this, and we can try to steel man it the best way we can.
All right, so the number one criticism that I've heard, and I tried to watch some conservative videos on this. I tried to watch a Ben Shapiro video. I got like 5 minutes in. I can't take it. But the number one criticism was Family Feud style. Ding, ding, ding. It's unfair to me because I paid off my student debt. Who cares?
Right.
I don't see that as a valid criticism. As we've talked about previously, see our redlining episode, life isn't fair for a lot of people. We can still try to do the best we can to make life better for everyone.
Well, and that's what blows my mind about this argument, where it's, I suffered, therefore I want you to suffer too. I don't understand it.
It's selfish.
Yes.
And it's mean-spirited.
Yes.
It's an Ayn Rand argument of screw everybody else, I gets mine.
Well, it's the radical individualism that we always talk about, where, I mean, heck, even the idea of just the only investment is the investment you make in yourself. Because all they care about is the individual. They don't even want to look at the system or the systemic problems we have in this country. We don't want to look at the populations and groups of people who are suffering because of short-term solutions not working out.
So I don't know what we can do to make that argument stronger, to say, why should somebody else get something that I didn't get?
Because you can make that argument about anything.
Literally. And I just don't think it holds any value. I had to struggle and save and put off all sorts of things so that I could pay off my student loans. Why should you have a better life than I did? Because it's a better life for someone. That's why we would want to do it in the first place. All you're doing is making the argument for doing that. Yes, those things were terrible. You shouldn't have had to go through that. We're going to make sure that no one else has to. Well, no, I want them to. Why? Because I had to.
Okay.
It's not much of an argument.
And that kind of brings us into our other one that you may hear a lot is, it's expensive.
Yeah, it is. We talked about it. It's $1.6 trillion.
Yeah.
It's not a small amount. So,
which for the record, like $50,000 debt would not even be canceling that entire amount. I want to make that very clear too. Like,
but I'm all for canceling all of it.
Right. But in fairness, we are looking at about a $1 trillion investment, which would be one of the biggest change investments in our country's history.
So let's look at some of the other big investments in our recent history. The war on terror since 2001 estimated that we've spent over $6 trillion just in monetary. That's not all of the lives that we've ended of innocent people in the Middle East, all of the United States soldiers that we've killed for pride, I suppose, but just monetarily, $6 trillion over 20 years. That's a lot of education that we could have paid for. I don't want to kill civilians in the Middle East, but I have to pay for that with my taxes. The TARP bailout in 2008, following the recession, $700 billion just in the direct TARP program. I've also seen, and I don't have near the time or resources to check into this, but I have seen figures as high as $14 to $16 trillion total that bailout is still costing the government. But we'll go with the $700 billion. And also, we had in 2017 the Trump tax cuts
for
the wealthiest individuals and corporations, which had an estimated cost of $1.9 trillion.
Ding, 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 ding. And there's our relief. But I really hate the disingenuousness of this whole argument, where the minute it becomes investing in your own country and your own people, whether it's healthcare, education, or just typical schools, you've heard that before, welfare programs like SNAP and things like that.
Welfare is not a dirty word, everybody.
No, it's not.
Think about welfare.
So when it's ever those, it's way too expensive. But when we're talking about things like going to war, cutting taxes for rich people, oh, we can take that then.
Anything that goes to corporations, we always find the money. The first stimulus of this year was like $1 trillion that mostly went to banks to hand out as they saw fit. No problem coming up with that money.
And I'm just so sick of watching the side who prides themselves on tax cuts also say that everything's too expensive at the same time. We can't handle this because it's way too expensive for us. Well, you're taking money out. You're taking our revenue away. Of course it is.
And we can always spend money on the military.
Yep. Another big criticism there is the worry that there's too much financial relief by executive action. And I've kind of heard this both from Democrats and Republicans here, where I think, Jason, we've talked about before in previous episodes, it's the idea of more power creep, the idea that with a strike of the pen, our president can just dole out $1 trillion for something in a non-emergency situation, although you could argue that it is an emergency.
I do worry about the executive branch's increase in powers over the last 30, 40 years.
And this is actually why you'll see Joe Biden pushing for a lower amount, like the $10,000 per person amount, as opposed to the $50,000 amount, because the higher you go, the harder the argument is to make that he can do it by executive action. The higher plan there is, like the Elizabeth Warren and Chuck Schumer plan, he's going to have to get congressional approval to do so or have Congress act on this first, which good luck with that.
Well, after the revolution, when all the guillotines have sung their song, we'll have no problem.
After we elect John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock to the Senate, then we can do that. But it's also kind of really hard to convince a lot of people that we need to spend a lot more money right now on, even though if it is for relief, also in the middle of a pandemic where we are also bailing out people and businesses a lot as well.
Except we're not actually doing that.
I mean, you're right, but that's the argument. And then finally, the idea of this is not a long-term solution.
Right. I've heard that argument. Well, what does this do? Oh, so we forgive the debt now, and then what? We just do it again in 20 years?
No, we restructure the system.
Yeah. See everything we just said about fixing the problem, too. That, again, that's just such a narrow attack of like, well, I can attack debt forgiveness by saying it doesn't fix anything for the future. Well, no one's really proposing all we do is forgive debt and do nothing else. There's always, plus we need to fix this, 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 and this.
Well, and you're seeing the same arguments being used for both points anyway, whether it's for student debt relief or if it's for making college more affordable. Even if you say, like, sure, you paid off your student loan debt and the people who still have to pay off their debt still have to do it, but from now on, from this point forward, we're going to make college free for any new incoming person. Well, now it's unfair still. Well, then when are we going to get better?
When they all have to take a trip to the guillotine. It's the perfect solution.
And then finally, this is one you may see a lot on like Fox News and Ben Shapiro.
I did hear Ben Shapiro make this argument too.
Why should I have to pay for someone to go to college for a useless degree?
Liberal arts majors.
I don't want to pay for some damn liberal in California getting a gender studies degree.
It's always the gender studies. They always say that. Well, as we talked about earlier, the people that tend to have more debt are actually STEM degree fields because that education is much more expensive. And who cares? You should be able to get a degree in whatever field suits your interests. It's not impossible to get a job with one of those degrees.
No.
As a journalist, Ben Shapiro should know that.
As a journalist with a useless law degree, Ben Shapiro should know that.
Also, how come the people that say that they worked so hard to pay off their student debt are also from super rich families? Like, you didn't really. We all know who was paying off those loans. Come on. Ben Shapiro does not fool me for a second. Did you see him try to cook a turkey?
No.
Oh, it was terrible. I don't watch the video because it's Ben Shapiro. But he's clearly never fed himself. That man has never not had someone cooking for him his entire life.
Oh, dear.
I worked hard to pay off my student loans. Yeah, did your butler write the check every month?
Well, I mean, useless degrees is synonymous with the idea of just, why should I pay for social programs because of welfare queens? It's just another boogeyman they use as a thought-stopping technique, which, if you listen to our last episode, is just a way that cult personalities use to indoctrinate people to make sure that they don't think too hard or critically about these complex subjects.
It's just a way to divide us and keep us fighting amongst themselves so we don't build the guillotines.
So, Jason, I want to make sure we have this correct here. I really want to steel man this. What are these conservative solutions for this problem?
Don't change anything. Keep people in debt their entire life. Make profit.
Privatize education?
Profit, 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 profit.
Perfect.
In closing, what would we be best for the United States, for humanity, is making things easier for future generations. Progressing, perhaps.
And while this may be a short-term solution, this will still benefit and help us with the right guidance and strategic decision-making in place.
And also, let's fix the system so that we also have the long-term solution.
Right, so we don't have this happen literally again.
You should not have to go in debt for the majority of your adult life in order to pay for an education.
Oh, and we totally forgot my favorite conservative point. Well, there's a way to pay for college. Join the army. You shouldn't have to risk your life.
Who pays for the army, Joe?
I believe the magical man in the sky does.
Okay.
With the religion bucks.
So, just free money for as many people as want to join the military.
I mean,
then we'll pay for it.
I mean, Republicans spend it like there is.
But if you don't join the military, then we won't pay for it. That is a horrible... We didn't even put that in the conservative art, because that is, like, way worse of an argument.
But you're right, though. You shouldn't have to go into debt. You shouldn't put your livelihood at risk just because you want to better yourself and your livelihood.
So
support these structural programs. Support investing in your labor. Support investing in your population so we can have a more educated population and help people push this country forward.
I want somebody who knows how to run the router and the Wi-Fi in my retirement home. Because I swear if my internet goes out, I'm going to be mad. So I wanted a well-educated young workforce by the time I get old enough to have to take advantage of it. and not somebody who's working 60 hours a week to pay for his crippling college debt, or her.
So this really does seem like the Democrats are using this as a way to gear up for their next big fight. So get ready to hear a lot more about this in the news. Get ready to hear some really bad arguments from conservatives and shut them down. Let's invest in our economy. Let's invest in our people.
Let's invest in guillotines.
After our education, because you need to know how to build them.
Yeah, you don't want poorly built.
Invest in engineering programs for people to make guillotines.
And then we eat the rich.
Invest in engineering programs and culinary schools, and then guillotines and eat the rich.
Good night, everybody.
Thank you for listening. We hope to see you in the next episode. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at ThinkProPod. You can email us at thinkpropod@gmail.com. And remember, when in doubt, think progressively. He finally gets to vote for the man he voted for.
Work for the man he voted
for? Yep, I fucked that up so bad. Let me try that again.
And you wonder why you're
shut
in on the
outfit. Shut up. I knew you were going to say it. Shut up. Oregon or Oregon?
Oregon.
Oregon.
You can say
Oregon Trail. You don't say Oregon Trail. Whatever, Oregon. I don't care.
Oregano.
Oregano. So I just wanted to read a little bit about this about section. Yeah, I'm gonna try. Do you like that?
About this about.
I mean, it was grammatically correct about this about section.
Yeah, I'm about it.
Yeah. But I really hate the dishonestness. Nah, disingenuity. Help me out here.
Dishonesty.
Yeah, but what's the disingenuousness? That's what I want. Okay. Yeah. But I really hate the disingenuousness.